Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Shaw, your host, and thank you so much for joining us today. If you're new here, thank you, and I do hope that you stick around. This is a show reflecting what I would call a bird's eye view of life, philosophically, psychologically, and metaphysically. And I have guests from a variety of interests and very diverse expertise. I speak with everyone from industry experts and actors to creatives, leaders in therapeutic change, and esoterically gifted healers working towards a better understanding of the human condition, mindful living, and experiential growth. And with that said, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show today, Deborah Green. Deborah is an energy healer. She works in energy medicine, and she has a PhD from Ohio State University. She has worked in energy medicine for over two decades. She combines the best of ancient wisdom and modern science, her private practice, her workshops, her lectures, and she's also an author. She's written a book called Endless Energy, The Essential Guide to Energy Health. And Deborah and I had a very good conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. The interview just flowed. She's a master teacher at Four Seasons Resort Costa Rica. She's also a wellness consultant at the Four Seasons Resort in Maui, where she offers energy psychology sessions and meditation classes. All of these things are close to my heart. And Deborah talks to us today about how we can use energy medicine. And we talk about kinesiology, you know, another one of my favorite modalities, and how it's used, how it can help you, why you might want to use it, and how you can use it yourself as well without having to go to a practitioner. It was really refreshing to hear someone else's view about how we are as human beings progressing or regressing into a world of self-change, self-development, self-healing, when we can reach out to other people or when we can take the responsibility on for ourselves, very much like in ancient times. And in ancient times, there was the wise woman or wise man down the road, you know, or up the hill, in the next valley, in the next town, in the next cottage. Those were the energy medicine people, the energy healers who mixed up herbs and spices and concoctions and, you know, tinctures. And they healed people. You know, they knew how to do anesthesia before we had it as a conventional, in a conventional way. We'd love you to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcast or wherever you're listening, and leave me a comment as well. It's really helpful just to know what you're thinking, know if you enjoyed the podcast. And my guests join me from all over the world. So we just had Mariah on the podcast. She was in Brazil. Deborah's in Hawaii. She shows us how to say it properly. Hawaii, I still don't say it properly. But it would be nice to hear from you all. So let's welcome Deborah to the show. Deborah, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Shaw. It's a pleasure.
So you've done so much work on with energy, and I just want to start out asking about energy. How do people connect with their energy, and what is energy?
Oh my, let's dive in. What an exciting question. So how do people connect with their energy? Well, I mean, most of us know when we feel energized or when we feel droopy or fatigued or like we're swimming against the current. And that, you know, is our energy level. And as you probably have noticed, if your energy level is low, for most people, we have a hard time functioning on any level. I mean, if you're feeling fatigued, de-energized, it's very difficult to bounce back when life challenges you in some way. It's difficult to feel joyful and happy, you know, when you're feeling that droopy. And it sometimes can be difficult to even think clearly because, you know, the mind doesn't function all that well. So, you know, that energy, that feeling of that get up and go energy, the vitality is huge. It's like fundamental to all aspects of our functioning. And the fascinating thing, Shaw, is that, like, if we traverse the planet looking for approaches to health and healing, we recognize that every single approach to health and healing in existence that we know of recognizes the primacy and importance of human energy, except for one. And that one is conventional Western medicine. Does not recognize the primacy or importance of human energy. And I have a little theory on that. My theory is that because Western medicine developed largely through the study of cadavers, you know, dissection and so forth. And I mean, when you're working with a cadaver, you are working with a dead body. So the life force energy, the etheric body, the vital body, whatever term you want to use to describe that, has already separated. And so that makes it kind of understandable about how conventional Western medicine or mainstream, you know, medicine missed this important feature of being alive, you know? And in other cultures, they were studying living beings, you know, they were studying people who were alive and well and flourishing. And I mean, another aspect of it is that in these other cultures where they were studying living beings, not only humans, but also plants and animals as well, they noticed that this energy component is pretty universal, you know, to all living things. And they also formed specific words for that human energy or that life energy. And for example, in India, in Ayurveda, which is the Hindu science of life, they call it prana. Mm-hmm. And in, you know, traditional Chinese medicine, they refer to it as qi. And so forth and so on. I mean, in Hawaii, where I spent, you know, 24 years of my life, the Hawaiians have a word for it. They call it mana. So it's one of the interesting things about the English language is that we do not have a word for human energy. We just have this word energy. And I don't know about you, but for me, when I tell people that I work with energy, they're like, oh, nuclear, solar, you know, wind, they only think about that form of energy. And so I really would love it if in the English language, we could have a word for human energy. And I actually created one.
Ooh.
Would you like to hear it?
Yes, please.
So it's energy, I-N-E-R-G-Y. And the reason I chose that word is because with us humans, it's not just energy, like the capacity to be vitalized and animated and alive and move around, but we also have these other dimensions to us that contain information. So when it comes to the human system, the human body, mind, spirit system, we can't really just talk about energy, because in the human system, energy is not discrete. It's not all by itself. It is intimately laced with information. And that's what makes us so wonderfully complex and amazing. Anyway, long answer, short question.
Whoa!
You actually asked two questions. What was the second part?
So how can people get in touch with their energy, but also what is energy? So you expanded upon the what is energy.
And how can people get in touch with their energy? Well, I mean, most of us are, because we realize if we feel fatigued or we feel, you know, super vitalized, but sometimes we get easily distracted. Like, you know, we're focusing on work, or we're focusing on our family, or we're focusing on, you know, whatever aspects of our life are calling forth our attention. And so one of the things that you can do is when you wake up in the morning, you can kind of take your energy temperature. You can take your, you just check in with yourself, right? You know, close your eyes for a moment and just notice, how am I feeling inside of myself right now in this moment? How am I feeling? Do I feel energized, or do I feel a little bit depleted? Sometimes it's helpful. I mean, I have to confess, I'm a little bit nerdy. And so sometimes it's helpful to use a scale, you know, like from 1 to 10.
Yeah.
And if you're feeling, you know, really drained and fatigued, you might be pretty low on the scale, like a 1 or 2 or 3 or something. Hopefully not, but you could be. And if you're feeling, you know, super energized, bubbly, effervescent, you know, like I can take on anything, you know, probably a 10, a 9. So it can be helpful to use that kind of a numeric scale, because then you'll find out what's your energy level, because we're all unique, and you can track it over time. You know, you can write it down, wake up in the morning, check in with your energy, put a number on it. And then the next day you can do the same thing. And then you'll have like a little chart that tells you, you know, is your energy fluctuating? Is it pretty steady? Are you feeling really good? Are you, you know, feeling droopy? And then you can start, if you're feeling good, you can start connecting to, okay, what is, you know, inspiring that feeling. And if you're feeling droopy a lot, then you can start looking into, okay, what is robbing? What is stealing my energy?
No, that's really good and very practical way as well, isn't it? To get in touch with your energy. Do you think that's why, you know, some people can go into a room, they feel up, happy, and then they leave and they're totally and completely drained. And I believe that's because, you know, you've connected with lots of other people's energies.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're very open and not closed enough or protected enough to not take on those energies. And I suppose it depends on how much you expend within that space or that room.
True.
So what are your thoughts about that?
I completely agree. You know, it does depend on how much energy you expend in that type of situation. And it also depends on how sensitive you are to other people's energies. And it depends on what's going on, you know, in that space. And a lot of it has to do with emotions, actually. There's some, you know, really interesting research done on emotions with humans. And I'm fascinated by this. It's called the contagion effect. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, if there's a person in a room who's feeling a strong emotion, if you then enter that room, within 10 minutes, you will begin to feel the same feeling, the same emotion, even if you are not looking at that person, even if the person is a complete stranger, even if you do not interact with them in any way, you will begin to feel the same feeling. And that's well established in the research, and it's referred to as emotional contagion. Like, our feelings, our emotions are contagious. And I remember the first time I heard about that research when I was, you know, an undergrad. And, you know, the teacher just sort of mentioned it in passing and then moved on. And I'm like, wait a minute, like, how does that work? Because according to mainstream medicine, our feelings and emotions are just a bunch of brain chemistry. That's it. So how does my brain chemistry affect your brain chemistry when we're not even touching, we're not even in physical proximity, we haven't spoken, I can't see you, and so forth and so on. How the heck do my brain chemicals end up, you know, affecting your brain chemicals? Of course, at the time when I first learned about the emotional contagion, I was not courageous enough to challenge and ask these questions, but it stayed with me. And it wasn't until I started discovering the science of subtle energies, the science of human energy, that I began to have an adequate explanation about how that works. Yes. And it works, of course, because we're not brain chemistry. You know, we are so much more than that. We have these other aspects, these other dimensions to us. And that's why the emotional contagion happens, because we human beings occupy multiple dimensions, multiple planes of existence simultaneously.
Yes, absolutely. It's very difficult sometimes when you say to someone, you know, we're not one dimensional. We imagine that. Imagine a one, no living thing, plant, animal, human, is one dimensional. But people, you know, especially a scientific mind, although, and I'm jumping around a bit, but although I know that recently there's a lot of research around emotions and our brains, and the CT scans are now showing when a person is dysregulated and when a person suffers from anxiety disorder as well. So there's some activity in the amygdala, and it's showing up as completely connected. So I think the research is being done, but obviously I think there needs to be more.
Well, the fascinating thing about, you know, fMRI research is that it's able to show us in real time what's going on, some of what's going on inside a person's brain when they're experiencing different feelings and thoughts and so forth. But mainstream science cannot tell us from where do the thoughts and feelings originate. And that's a hugely important point, because basically our brain is an organ of receptivity. It's receiving these energy information frequencies from these dimensions, and then it's displaying them in the brain. And so then we can see the picture, you know, through scans and so forth of what's going on. It's much like with a computer. I mean, we have a computer screen, a monitor that displays things, but the information does not originate in the screen. The information doesn't originate in the monitor. It originates somewhere else. And so our brain is kind of like the computer screen, because it's displaying these things, but it is not originating. It's not creating the thoughts and emotions. It's simply showing us, you know, what they are.
Yes, I think that's such a good point and an important point in our age of AI. And, you know, I was in a conversation the other day, and people were saying, well, you know, AI will eventually replace the therapist. And I said, I don't think so. I cannot see, and I could be wrong. I don't believe I am, but I could be, how someone as multidimensional as a human being can affect the same thing in a robot. I cannot, one-to-one in a room, you know, between the therapist and the client, I cannot see how that could be replicated.
I would agree with you. And I would say it depends on what the person's needs are.
Yes.
Because some people, I think it's fair to say, are in therapy because they want companionship.
Absolutely.
They want somebody to talk to and share their deepest, darkest secrets, and, you know, so forth and so on. And if that is your need, then perhaps AI could fulfill that. It can certainly listen and you know, give some kind of response. But if somebody needs more help on these other levels, which become very complex very quickly, and most good therapists are highly intuitive. Mm-hmm. And to the best of my knowledge, AI is not capable of intuition.
Absolutely not. Yeah, which is a lot of what music and art is based upon, and that is intuition. And so I can't see it replacing a lot of that. But that's a whole nother topic on a whole nother day, I suppose.
It's a very timely, interesting topic. But yes, not my area of expertise, I will say.
Nor mine, but I can have an opinion.
Yes, me too.
You know, Deborah, what is inner clarity? I see. Tell us a bit about that.
So thank you for asking. Inner clarity is a healing modality that I developed over decades, actually. I've been doing, you know, this type of healing work for almost 30 years now. And inner clarity is grounded in the science of subtle energies that has been handed down to us through the Eastern cosmology, through the esoteric teachings. Primarily, I've been a very long time student and teacher of the esoteric teachings of Alice Bailey, who, of course, her work was in collaboration with the Tibetan master Dzogchen. So that informs a lot of the work that I do and informs the inner clarity work. And so the steps to an inner clarity process are, first we establish a clear intention for the session, because we know that energy follows intention. And there is so much research backing that up. I mean, we could have a whole podcast on the power of intention, but suffice to say that there are at this point hundreds of research studies demonstrating the power of human intention to affect us on all levels and even on the physical. In fact, if you're willing, Shah, we could do a little experiment right now.
Let's go. Let's do it.
With our intention. I'm diverting from answering your question, but I'll come back to it to tell you about the rest of inner clarity stuff, okay? I want to carpe diem. I want to seize this moment to do this little experiment. Now, I realize that probably a lot of our listeners may be driving, and so do not try this in the car, I will say, because it involves your hands for a moment. But do try it at home for sure. Or if you're not driving, join in us right now. Join with us. So we have our two hands. And if you want to participate in the experiment, I would need your hands to not have any kind of writing utensil or anything. We just want your hands. And if you could put them palms up, both hands, palms up, and then hold your hands together, you know, side by side, palms facing up. And as you do this, you'll probably notice that there are some creases at the base of your palm. I want you to use those creases as markers and line up the creases at the base of your palm, close to your wrist. Use those creases as markers, align them, and then fold your hands together like prayer position. Now, the reason that we're doing this is because this is an experiment and we want to do a before and after comparison. So that's why we're using those lines, those crease lines at the base of the palms as markers. We're lining them up, matching them, and then folding the hands together into a prayer position. And then the next step is, I want you to just notice your two hands. Are they the same size or not? Sometimes our hands are exactly the same size, the fingers, the thumb, the palms, everything. And sometimes maybe one finger or, you know, however many might be a little bit longer. And right now you just want to notice that. So you're just making a mental note. Are my hands the same size or not? And for me in this moment, my two hands, when I line them up, they're pretty much the same size.
Mine too.
Yeah. Okay. So then the next step is, once you've made a mental note, you've observed, you know, the two hands and how they compare, then just let one hand, you know, relax so that you have only this other hand in front of you. So one hand in front of you, make sure it's your own. And from this moment on, I want you to focus your whole attention on this chosen hand, okay? And a big part of this experiment is about the ability to concentrate and hold a focus. So we have this one hand in front of us, and to help you focus and concentrate on the hand, it's easier to do that if you close your eyes, because the visual sense tends to pull us out of our inner self. So you want to just close your eyes so that you can focus inside and have your attention on this hand. And I'm doing the experiment as well as I'm guiding us through it. So my eyes are closed. I have my right hand in front of me. I'm focusing my whole attention on this right hand and not allowing any other thoughts to come in, to the best of my ability. So as you focus on the hand, the first thing I want you to do is, I want you to talk to your hand, self-talk, right? So you don't have to say this out loud. You can if you want, but you don't have to. You can just use your inner self-talk, and you want to send a message to the hand. This is a clear message. You are telling the hand, you have become extremely big. Hand, you have become very, very large. Hand, you have become this huge, enormous, gargantuan, gigantic hand. Fingers extending out into space, thumb as well, palm, thick, huge. So you are telling, you're talking to your hand, and you're saying these messages to it, directly to the hand. Step two, I want you to please, to the best of your ability, visualize in your mind's eye that your hand has grown to be so enormous. See it to the best of your ability. Just, some people, you know, can visualize easily, some can't. Don't worry about that. Use your intention. Visualize the hand to be extremely, massively huge. Third step, your hand has grown so enormous that you can barely hold it up. It is so heavy, and you can feel how heavy it is. Oh, the hand has become so huge that it's so heavy you can barely hold it up. I'm going to be silent for a few moments so that you can continue to send these messages to your hand without having to listen to me. Focus and send these messages to the hand. Just take a moment to do that, please. All right. Whenever that feels complete, you can open your eyes. You can line up your two hands using those creases. Write the markers. We're just going to repeat what we did before. Now, I don't know if you can see it on, if you're looking at the screen, but my right hand has actually physically gotten bigger. How's yours, Shaw?
Yeah, certainly my left, which was what I was focusing on, my thumb is higher.
Yeah. And like, how much bigger would you say it is?
Well, not significantly bigger, but bigger.
Yeah. For me, my thumbs are the same. My index finger has grown by approximately a quarter of an inch. Middle finger has grown even longer than that. All the fingers are longer by at least a quarter of an inch. I would say my middle finger has grown by about half an inch. The palms, not so much, mostly the fingers this time.
So that's the power of the mind.
This is the power of your mind using intention to physically alter reality.
Never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button right now. Thank you for your support. You make this podcast possible. Now, back to the show.
And I can tell you, Shaw, I have facilitated this little experiment many, many times with people, all varieties, all walks of life, all ages, all ethnicities, whatever, groups of different sizes, one-on-one, small group, big auditorium, whatever. And always, always at least 85% of the people are able to physically grow their hand like that. Always 85%, oftentimes even more. So please realize the importance of using intention, because it's available to you all the time. And if you can use your intention, I mean, what, we probably took maybe 2 minutes to do that little exercise. I mean, if you can grow your physical hand in just 2 minutes of focused intention, imagine what you could do if you repeated that, you know, each day, once a day, twice a day. Imagine what you could achieve.
Yeah. Oh, that was a great experiment as well. And to physically see something helps, I think, because you know the power of the critical mind. So when you physically see something, it really be convincing. And so many people talk about intention, but I'm not quite sure they understand or even believe in intention and its purpose and its practicality. So I'm so glad you did that experiment. That's fantastic. I'm sure our listeners, our viewers, let us know, guys, put in the comments, let us know what happened when you did that experiment. Please let us know.
It's very interesting to see how much people's hands grew. So yeah, that's a fun way to do it. And I'll just take a moment, because sometimes there's maybe one person, two people, whatever. There's like, my hand didn't grow. What's wrong with me? Well, don't worry about it. I mean, you can repeat the experiment on your own, probably have a little more success. But the thing is that if it didn't work, it's probably because on some level you had some
resistance.
Lapse. You had some lapse in concentration. Right. You had some lapse in your ability to stay focused. And, you know, it could be that little voice of doubt, you know, like, oh, I don't believe this, or, you know, some voice saying, oh, this is silly, or, you know, some voice saying, where is this going? I don't understand, or whatever, you know. We all have those little voices, right? And when that happens, it breaks concentration, right? It breaks your ability to actually focus. And so if that resonates with you, you might want to try the experiment again and just do your best to really, you know, stay present and focused with the experiment, because you can do it. It's not hard. Yes. And one of the things that we did that helps to potentize intention is, you might have noticed this, we brought in these different channels of inner expression. The first one was self-talk. Okay. The second one was visualization. And we pictured, you know, what we wanted. And the third one was some kind of sensation, the feeling, the kinesthetic. So when you're able to add those three different dimensions to your intention, it helps to potentize it a lot.
That's fantastic. I would also add to anybody out there who has the critical mind is good, but if you did intend that it wouldn't work, then it worked. So if your intention was, this isn't going to work, then there's your proof. It didn't work because you didn't intend it to work. So just always cover that part. We have to be aware of intention, as you're saying.
Absolutely. And how we sabotage ourselves, right? Because as you so poignantly said, if I have doubt or fear or worry, and which is kind of, you know, negative stinking thinking in a way, I mean, voila, it can happen. And it's like, imagine if we redirected that in the direction that we want to go. Imagine how empowered we could be.
That's a really good point. So guys, look at energy and intention. Speaking of energy, you're an author as well, Deborah. I don't know how you find the time or where you got the time or find this. Because you're doing workshops, lectures, so busy, but endless energy. Tell us about your book.
I will. And I'm also going to return to inner clarity.
Oh, good.
Finishing the description.
Yes.
Which one would you like me to do first?
Let's finish in a clarity.
Okay, thank you. So we set an intention for our session, for our work together, because we know energy follows intent. And then the second step is that I do a clearing process. And I do kinesiology muscle testing, although what I do is actually energy testing, which is a much more subtle form of muscle testing. And because I'm very tuned into energies and information, it also allows me to do the work that I do remotely. I don't need to be in physical contact with an in-person, you know, session. So, you know, I do Zoom sessions and phone sessions and things like that. So I use the feedback of the energy kinesiology to first do a clearing process, checking different parameters so that I know that I have a clear connection, a clear channel of communication, right? Energy, information, communication. And
what kinesiology is, sorry, Deborah, just because some people may not know about this beautiful, wonderful, I call it a science, kinesiology, which I love.
Yes. It is a science and it's an art.
Yes.
It's actually both. Oh, how to describe kinesiology? Well, I mean, it's used by a lot of different practitioners. For example, a lot of chiropractors use kinesiology in their chiropractic practice, but they tend to use a form of kinesiology that's very physical, you know, because they're a chiropractor. And so they're isolating muscles and so forth and so on. The way that I use kinesiology, I'm mostly interested in using it as a feedback, a very sensitive feedback mechanism that allows me and my client to get energy information, you know, from the person. And when I'm doing an in-person session, of course, I'm physically muscle testing a person, which involves the person just holding out one of their arms, and I apply a little bit of light touch pressure to the extended arm just above the wrist. And it's a binary code, because when a little bit of pressure is applied, the arm will either respond with a strong, so-called switched on response, or it will dip ever so slightly and produce what's called a switched off or a weak indicator. And so that's that binary code, right, which is two messages, strong, weak, can be used to communicate with the body, mind, spirit system. And you can ask questions and you can get amazing answers from the body, mind, spirit system. And the beauty of the kinesiology energy testing is that it has the capacity to kind of bypass the concrete mind and to bypass, you know, a lot of our defense mechanisms and just go straight to, you know, the truth, we could say, to the core of what we need, what we're looking for. And so when energy kinesiology is used in a therapeutic setting, it can really streamline a therapeutic process because we don't have to get lost in story. We can use the feedback of the energy kinesiology to pinpoint exactly what we're looking for. What is getting in the way? What is the core cause? What is the root of this person's issue? And so that's the beauty of it. It makes for a very elegant, non-invasive, efficient approach to working with the body, mind, spirit system. And that's why I use it and what I love about it. And again, I mean, it can be done in person. It can also be done at a distance. And so in my inner clarity process, we establish our intention. And then the next step is to, after the clearing, is to then go through and pinpoint everything that is blocking the person from manifesting whatever that goal or intention is. And we systematically go through and find everything. And again, it's very efficient and actually kind of fun, in my opinion. I mean, it's what I love about my work. It's always an adventure. No two people are the same. I never know where we're going to go in a session. And it's always just a really beautiful process of discovery.
Yeah.
Person is discovering what is getting in the way. And many times it's something like something that they didn't know about, right? Like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. And that's what creates a shift, because the new awareness, the insight, that aha, is what creates the shift in consciousness, which is where all true healing happens. And then to reinforce that shift in my inner clarity work, we then do what in kinesiological terms is called a balance, because we want to rebalance the energy system, the energy information system, according to this new way of being, right? And so the system that I practice has over 50 different balance options, and they're all different. So it's challenging for me to say, oh, here's what a typical balance is, because they're all different. But you know, it ranges from utilizing acupressure points. Sometimes I work with sacred symbols, sometimes visualizations, meditation, sometimes movement. It's a huge, massive toolkit, big toolkit. So facilitating that balance, and then we go back and we recheck. We recheck everything. We recheck all that has been discovered that was getting in the way, which usually takes the form of limiting beliefs or emotional triggers or patterned behaviors, stuff like that. So we go back and we recheck all of that and make sure that everything has cleared, has released. And then every time a person releases a limiting belief, they get to consciously choose what they want instead. So we don't just leave it as a vacuum. We put in, we reprogram, we insert the new, you know, for example, belief system that a person wants, and they choose that consciously. And that gets anchored in kinesiologically at the level of energy and information. So that is, and then usually there's a little fun homework assignment, which I refer to as home play, because it's usually fun homework. So anyway, that's inner clarity in a nutshell, probably more like a coconut, but anyway, a nut.
Fantastic. Yeah, very inclusive, but non-invasive, as you've said. And when I did my training in kinesia, and I do miss it, I, you know, over the years, and when I trained in all my holistic therapies, it was early 90s and everything was available. It was at the real start of that push. I was like the only hypnotherapist in my area and the only, and I was busy and booked, you know, because there was nobody else doing it. And then, so kinesiology was brilliant. So as I hear you talk about it, I do miss doing it. I think somehow we just find our niche, and for me, it was talking therapies, however that happened, but also hypnotherapy. But yes, viewers, listeners out there, I can tell you through my own experience of using kinesiology and of practicing it, it is a beautiful, wonderful way to just get to the point. But you've got to have somebody trained to help you. Now you'll see videos, I'm sure they're out there, where you can do it yourself. And yes, you can. But having a facilitator help you to pinpoint and to get to bits where you will probably miss, because a lot of it's unconscious. And that will be the skill of your facilitator, your therapist, to help you get there, because they've got the experience and the knowledge to do so. So I would just say, check out Deborah's website, because she is doing Zoom and phone sessions as well.
Yes. Can I mention my website?
Yes. Yes. And I'm going to put it in the show notes.
Oh, thank you. It's yourenergymatters.com. And I will say, just to piggyback on what you said so eloquently, my sessions are very participatory, interactive. It you know, the work requires the involvement of the person in their own healing. It's very much a reciprocal, you know, kind of thing. Yes.
Important. Very important for all healing therapies. So we were going to talk about your book.
Thank you. Yes. My book, Endless Energy, The Essential Guide to Energy Health. So the book is a labor of love. And basically, it's kind of like a workbook in a way, because there are tons of tools, you know, in there. And it constitutes multi-dimensional self-care. It's really a lesson, kind of an encyclopedia. It's a merge between an encyclopedia and a workbook. It's a lesson in our energy bodies. I refer to them as energy bodies, which means the vital body, which is sometimes called the etheric body or the biofield. So it's the use and care of your vital body. First, I teach you about, you know, the vital body. The book is set up kind of like a coaching session where I'm holding your hand and, you know, walking you through the whole thing. So we focus on the vital body first. And every chapter that first gives the information is followed by a chapter of tools and tips and techniques and methods that you can use for that particular body. So that's the vital body. Then we move on to the emotional body. And in that chapter, I teach you everything about your emotional body, which is sometimes also referred to as the astral body, because it occupies the astral plane of existence. And then it's followed by a chapter of use and care, like, you know, tools, tips, and techniques for caring for your emotional body. Then we move on to the mental body, same thing. One chapter educating about how our mental body works, followed by a chapter of tools, tips, and techniques to care for it. And then last, certainly not least, the spiritual body, which I refer to as the universal body, because sometimes I find that if I use the word spiritual body, people automatically think about religion. And I mean, these energy bodies have nothing to do with religion. They're not something you believe in or you don't believe in. They simply are. They simply exist. And so with the spiritual body or universal body, it's the same thing. There's a chapter describing it and followed by a chapter of how to care for your spiritual body, tips, tools, techniques. And then the last couple of chapters are bringing the bodies back together and how do they function? How do they work together? And what can I do to help them, you know, work together in a more integrated, cohesive way so that we can have more coherence in our lives? Because, you know, oftentimes we don't do what we say we're going to do, right? Like you decide, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to eat dessert tonight. And then the next thing you know, you're eating whatever. Or you make up, you know, I'm not going to yell at my kids tonight. And then blah, there you go. You know, why? Why do we not do what we say we're going to do? Well, it's because our bodies are not integrated, right? They do in a way represent parts of us. And they're not integrated oftentimes, you know, vital body wants one thing, emotional body wants something else, you know, mental body wants its whatever, and we get pulled in these different directions. And so the book is to help you operate as a cohesive whole more in the world so that you can be more empowered and more coherent as a system and achieve what you want, you know, your soul purpose.
Yes, in a natural way, because that it's all natural, isn't it? That's the whole and holistic and getting, yeah, exactly.
I love that. That is the whole, yeah. The holism in holistic. Absolutely. That's beautiful. I'm going to use that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's I'm using it in my book. I am writing. I'm almost done.
Yay.
Let's get philosophical just for a moment, because that's what we like to do here. If you could have, let's just say, 1 hour with one person, living or dead, and I know a lot of people ask similar questions, but I'm particularly interested in speaking with people like yourself who work with energies and know about Eastern philosophies. And, you know, you've got what I would call a wider view of our existence on this earth plane. So who would you choose to spend time with? 1 hour, just to shoot the breeze, living or past?
What an interesting question.
And why?
Who comes to my mind is Paramahansa Yogananda. And, you know, he wrote Autobiography of a Yogi. That's probably one of his most, you know, well-known works. And why him? Because he was an extremely advanced being and had extraordinary experiences in his life. And if you want to learn about those, I do recommend that you read Autobiography of a Yogi. And I think I think if he were alive now, you know, he could shed some light on what's going on in the world right now, because, you know, things are a little bit challenging these days, shall we say? I mean, the world has changed a lot just in the last couple of years, you know. So That would be my choice. I think that would be really interesting to have a conversation with him.
Absolutely. The beginning of that book always strikes me because of how the conversation went and when he was younger and things like that. So I always, yes, I could, when as soon as you said that, I thought, well, I don't need to ask why now. You know, I know why you would choose him.
I have to tell you, Shah, though, that the first time I read the book, or I should say tried to read the book, I couldn't. I just barely got into it. I mean, I didn't get into it. I barely read, and I just had to put it down. And I was like, this is a crock. I mean, I couldn't go there. I could not believe what he was sharing. And it wasn't until years later that, you know, I had enough experience, maturation, awakening, whatever, that I could actually read the book and comprehend it and stay with it and believe it, you know. And I've read it, you know, a couple of times since, because it's so packed, you know. There's always something new in there.
Yes, I think if I hadn't had some insights before. And my trouble was, I was reading, like all of us, when we were on a spiritual path, I had Ram Dass, I had everybody, you know, and I was reading them all at once, just reading everything, you know. And so I had to go back and, yeah, absolutely. But
so you were doing the immersion approach.
I did the immersion course. I was doing that, exactly. But, and on top of that, my mediumship was blowing up, as the kids would say. So I was really boom, boom. It was, I think I was just open for receiving so much stuff. But you're right. I mean, I still refer to it. I still have to go back. I forget things, but yeah, amazing stuff. So thank you for that.
Thanks for asking.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall for that hour.
It happens, I'll let you know.
Oh, please do.
Anything is possible, you know.
You know, Deborah, many people struggle with limiting beliefs, limiting doubts. And I know we could look at it systemically and say, okay, family issues, which are true. We learn most of what we do from those who we were around. But I believe anything that's learned can be unlearned, mostly. Hand gestures, the way we walk, a bit more difficult. We get those from family members as well. But what are your thoughts about how people can begin to drop and let go of some of their limiting beliefs, these habits that come up for them time and time and time again? And they're on a spiritual path, but they're finding it difficult. You know, things like anger, things like, I'm just thinking of some of the things people have brought to me in a spiritual sense, in spiritual ways to deal with. What would you suggest?
Yes. Well, for me, there's a difference between anger, which is an issue, and limiting beliefs. Because in my work, limiting beliefs are quite specific. And it's like a lock and key. Mm-hmm. You know, once you're able to zero in on and find, you know, those limiting beliefs, it really is like lock and key, where, you know, the energy gets freed up, the information gets freed up, and it causes the whole system to reconfigure. I think one of the important things, you know, for all of us in terms of our limiting beliefs is to be aware of them, because that's the challenge, right? I mean, oftentimes those limiting beliefs are behind the scenes, you know, they're lurking around in the background, you know, pulling the strings, so to speak. And we're not aware of it. we're only aware of, oh, I have this issue, or I have this problem, or this person is treating me like this, and I'm unhappy about that. And we're focusing on that, which is not where the action is. You know, the action is, okay, what is my part in this? So you have to, you know, step one is to change the focus away from out there, this person this and that person that and this situation and whatever, and to look inside instead. That's, you know, essential. And then once you start looking inside, you need to ask yourself, what is my part in this? What is my part? Because we always, no matter what it is, I dare to say, no matter what the situation is out there, we always have a part in it. And sometimes that's hard to see. That's hard to own. That's hard to admit. But, you know, it's very, very important to find that, because, you know, you can change friends until you're blue in the face. You can change partners until you're blue in the face. You can move to different locations. You can switch jobs. You can whatever. And you will find that the same situation will keep presenting itself over and over again, unless and until you look inside you to find out what is your part in that.
Yes.
That's the key right there. And, you know, to look at the stuff that's hard to look at, but it's very, very important, because if it shows up out there, it already exists in here.
Absolutely.
And I will also say that, I mean, from the perspective of energy and information, I mean, energy can neither be created nor destroyed.
Right.
And so that means that sometimes we also have to look at karma.
Yes.
Sometimes right. We also have to look, okay, if it doesn't make any sense in this lifetime, if I can't find my part in it here, maybe it's something from, you know, the ancestors, maybe it's something from the distant past, and so forth and so on. So it's a very, very big picture perspective. But that is required of us. Because of our multidimensional nature, we are big. we are so, so extraordinary. And that means that we have to have a big picture perspective when we're understanding ourselves, you know? Don't play small.
Yes. I would say, though, in my practice, I have found a very close correlation between limiting beliefs and anger. And it's only because sometimes people are very unaware, as you were saying, you know, you've got to be aware of it, that perhaps they believe that they're not good enough, or they're not smart enough. And so therefore, when they're in that board meeting and somebody questions them about their presentation, a part of their presentation, their go-to is anger. How dare you? I've been in this role for how long? How dare you question with us? So, and that's because they're unaware of this unconscious limiting belief that they're just not good enough, or that their parents instilled in them, they've got to work hard, they've got to work harder than everybody else, they've got to work. So when somebody questions this, it comes out as anger, because that's the go-to. It couldn't come out as anger when they were little, because there were consequences to that. So it's only in my private practice that I have found that correlation. I need to do some more research on that as well. And I know I need to write about these things. You know, it takes a lot of time. I always say I'm in the stage now where I'm still doing my one-to-one practice. And so I've got to limit my time. I've got to have a life as well. But yeah, there can be, and I probably not always, because I agree with you, limiting beliefs are quite specific. But sometimes I believe, like all things, there can be a correlation between them, but it's unconscious. You're not aware that your voice has reached this decibel because you stood in the queue for, I don't know, whatever, or the salesperson's talking. I'm thinking of things I've seen recently in places where the response has been disproportionate to the situation. And so for someone like myself, my ears perk up. I'm watching, I'm looking, what's going on there? And then unfortunately, I'm thinking, okay, this is what's happening. I don't want to do all that, but it's in built in us when we do this work, I think.
I totally understand. And, I think in general, many people have a lot of built up, probably anger, because of what's happened in the last, couple of years. People are angry. And frankly, I don't blame them. But the problem is that it's kind of on a collective level now, right? So even people who in the past might not be as prone, to anger or frustration or irritation find themselves more easily going into it because it's collectively, we're all together, right? We all participate in that, and we're all, feeling it. The astral plane, the emotional plane, is extremely agitated right now. And I think people are definitely getting affected by that. And I mean, the interesting thing about anger is that oftentimes, and I'm sure you've, discovered this in your practice, like you mentioned that it's a go-to. And oftentimes anger becomes a go-to emotion because it's strong, it's protective, there's no vulnerability. I mean, it's a very different thing for me inside myself to experience anger than it is for me to experience I'm not good enough or I'm not worthy or, those weaker, more much more vulnerable kinds of feelings, right? So anger can easily become the go-to because I don't want to be vulnerable. I need to protect myself. But if you're able to go behind that, I mean, anger is like a mask, right? If you're able to go behind that, oftentimes we do find what you've described exactly. And that's where the work needs to be done.
Absolutely. Speaking of which, we're in the information age, aren't we? There was the Stone Age, the Ice Age, all these, billions of years ago, but we're in the information age. So, people are missing, I believe, and I want to hear your thoughts on this. The anxiety levels have risen. People are requesting medication from their GPs. In the UK, it's risen. And so a lot of people go straight to medication because,
Same with US, absolutely.
okay, they go straight to, so they want medication. But because we're in the information age, and I don't know, I ponder about these things, I'm wondering if people are just overexposed and what they're missing is that they can actually regulate that. Nobody's forcing you to look at your phone constantly or to have your computer on all day or to watch, I don't know, reality TV, whatever it is that's causing your anxiety. Anger is another thing. People were telling me recently, oh, the internet's so angry, Twitter's so angry. Yes, okay. Twitter is not angry. It's people who are typing into Twitter that's angry, but also you're reading it. So we are responsible. We're the boss of us, and we're responsible for what we expose ourselves to mostly. I mean, sometimes you can't help what you find yourself in. But what are your thoughts about how we can start to take responsibility for that. And, you know, it's something I'm going back to what you said earlier in the interview that, you know, people have to participate within their own healing. And so we've got to take responsibility for what we expose ourselves to and what we allow in.
Absolutely.
Is it helpful for us? I mean, it's wonderful, the technology age we're in, the information age. But is it helpful to feel that you've got to see everything? Or is it all the fear of missing out?
Well, yes, you're bringing up a topic that is near and dear to me on a couple of different levels. So one is, I mean, I'm just saying this now because I don't want to forget to say it. Okay. And we can come back to it if you want to.
Yes.
But there is a tremendous amount of evidence that we are now moving from the information age into the age of consciousness. There is a tremendous amount of evidence in multiple fields of endeavor, multiple disciplines, research. And so that to me is so exciting and so uplifting and so hopeful. And so I just wanted to put that out there because I didn't want to forget to say it.
I hope that's the case. Yes.
Yes. And again, there's a ton of evidence to support that. It's not just my opinion. It's, yeah. And I mean, I guess I should give credit where credit's due. I just attended, I'm looking at the date because I think it was 2 weeks ago. Time is such a phenomena. I attended the 25th annual ASEP conference, which is energy psychology. It's the Association for Comprehensive Energy Psychology. And so they've been, you know, hosting conferences for 25 years. And I presented at this conference, as I have many times in the past. And one of the keynote presenters was Dean Radin. Dean Radin is the principal researcher at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is in California in the US. And IONS is devoted to studying consciousness and paranormal phenomena, studying it in very, very rigorous scientific ways. And Dean's keynote address was all about this topic of paradigm shift. In other words, shifting from this information age into the age of consciousness. And being the good, you know, scientist researcher that he is, you know, he gave all of the evidence, maybe not all of it, but a vast number of studies from different disciplines supporting this notion that we are in a transition, in a late transition, not the beginning of, but in the later stages of a transition into the age of consciousness. So anyway,
I have read that before. I have read that. I can't remember who I got it from or where I read it. Yes, yes.
Yeah, but it's very cool and very, very exciting and very uplifting. So there's that. So the other thing is about technology. So technology these days, and I'm talking about, you know, stuff that you find on a smartphone mostly, because that's the main device that people utilize now. Smartphones and apps are meant to be, they're designed to be addictive. They are addictive by design. And so that's one of the factors that makes it very challenging for people. It's not just fear of missing out. It's that everything about that particular app or medium is designed to be addictive. And the algorithms that they're using now, extremely complex and sophisticated. And, you know, they're designed to be addictive. So that's one piece of that puzzle, the content. The other piece of the puzzle is the apparatus itself, which cell phones emit wireless radiation. And wireless radiation operates mostly in the microwave frequency range, like your microwave oven, right? And many people don't know that. And many people don't know that wireless radiation is extremely harmful. So the research on that is again off the charts. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to bioinitiative.org. And you can go to Children's Health Defense, and you can go to the Environmental Health Trust.
I'll put those links in the
I will provide those. Especially EH Trust, Environmental Health Trust, their website is extremely comprehensive. So I'm very happy, Shah, to see that you are using, for example, wired earbuds. I'm proud of you. I commend you. I admire you for that, because you are taking a step to help protect yourself, as opposed to using the wireless earbuds, which people put into their ear canal, which shoots the wireless microwave radiation directly into the brain, because there's no cranial bones, there's nothing to protect at all. And we're seeing all kinds of negative health effects because of cell phones and Wi-Fi and wireless Bluetooth, this and that, and neurobehavioral problems, and very sad, tragic developments in younger people, not only on the physical level with increases in, for example, colon cancer in young people. I mean, this is a very new thing. Colon cancer used to be a cancer exclusive to the elderly, and now we're finding it in young people. Well, guess why? A lot of young people have a tendency to carry the cell phone in their back pants pocket. We're also seeing an increase in breast cancer in young women. Why is that? Again, used to only happen in older women, now young women. A lot of young women have this bad habit of putting the cell phone inside their bra, carrying it there. Really bad idea. Lowered sperm counts, reduction in sperm motility in young men. Why is that?
Yeah, huge.
Why is that? Guys have a tendency to carry their cell phones in their front pants pocket, right next to the family jewels. So not a good idea. I can go on and on, and I won't. Anyway, you know, the research is there. There's really no question right now about whether or not this wireless radiation is harmful. It has been shown definitively, but the research is being ignored. It's being discounted. It's being hidden. We're talking about a multi-trillion-dollar industry here. And just like, you know, smoking, and the tobacco industry, big tech, big telecom, they're following the same playbook. You know, big tobacco knew that cigarettes were highly addictive. They knew that they were dangerous. They knew that they were carcinogenic. They hid all of the information for decades. You know, millions of people had to suffer and die before things were changed. We are in that same place with wireless radiation. The evidence is there. The research is there. It's being suppressed. The additional thing that's happening now is that, at least in the U.S., the governing agencies, for example, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which is charged with protecting us, that agency has been completely overtaken and captured by the industry that it's supposed to be regulating. So it's another
reason. No independent body? There's no independent body who could...
It's supposed to be the independent body, but they've been captured. So it's another reason why we are not being protected and why people really need to educate themselves about this issue, learn about it. There are things that you can do. There are steps that you can take. You don't have to throw your phone away. You know, you don't have to stop using the technology, but there are steps that you can take to help you keep yourself safer and protected from the wireless radiation. And I founded a coalition called Safe Tech Hawaii, and you can check them out at safetechhawaii.com. And we actually have on there a class that is about how to create a safer, you know, work environment, a safer home environment. And it's a little 30-minute class that will teach you about easy, inexpensive steps that you can take to make your devices and your space more EMF safe. So, you know, it's just a matter of education. And it's a fascinating thing to me, Shah, because I'm sure that most of your viewers and listeners are health conscious.
Yes.
You know, we eat organic, we drink pure water, you know, we pay attention to what we put in our bodies. And yet, when it comes to this wireless radiation issue, there is not the awareness. So please educate yourselves. It is a toxin. It is very, very bad for us. And, you know, take the time, learn about it, investigate. It's, you know, it's cell phones, it's Wi-Fi, it's smart meters, you know, it's the smartwatch, the Fitbits, the smart washer and dryer and the smart ceiling. It's anything smart communicates wirelessly, mostly. Exactly. So anyway, I mean, I could go on and on about that too, but it's please pay attention to it. If you care about your health and wellness, and especially that of your children are way more susceptible to this. And again, it's physical, but it's also behavioral, it's psychological. I mean, there's enough research right now that shows that people, kids who grew up with cell phones, because I didn't, right? But kids, we now have kids who have grown up with cell phones from moment one, and they are in trouble.
Hugely.
Especially mental health stuff.
Hugely. We've seen an increase. Children's services over here, there's an increase. I mean, it's just the need for therapists in that area at the moment is just huge. So yes, I certainly see it. And also having a conversation with someone now. And then again, I always like to say, I'm going to sound like the old lady shouting at clouds, but the conversation that I'm having with under 16s is very different from when I had a conversation with my parents or with someone. It's just, you know, even the vocabulary.
And it's one of the things, it's one of the skills, the life skills that has been lost and compromised is the ability to interact human to human. Because most young people who grew up with phones, they interact with the world, including humans, through the phone, not, you know, human to human. And if they want to, you know, communicate with somebody, they don't go see the person or meet somewhere. It's all, even if the person is in the next room, you know, you'll be getting a text message. Instead of they, you know, stand up, walk over there and, you know, speak to the person and so forth and so on. I mean, they also have a tendency to be extremely fear-filled and anxious almost all the time. And they, you know, instead of going outside and having some kind of adventure, you know, I mean, doing something out in nature or going to a new place, no, they have to look it up on the phone first. They have to read about it. They have to look at all the comments and what are people saying about this. And then they make a decision if they want to do it or not, instead of just go for it, you know? And oftentimes the answer is, no, I'm not going to do that because, of course, there's a negative comment or something, right? Because everybody has a negative comment.
It's a whole different world.
Very different world.
I'm glad we're here to see it. But it is a challenge, I will admit, for me, it's a challenge.
Yes, me too. And I mean, change, I have no problem. But in my opinion, I don't think we're going in a good direction with that. And again, I'm just going to loop back around and say, it's one of the reasons why I'm so ecstatic about the evidence of us moving from this information age into the age of consciousness, because that's what's going to save us. Wonderful. That is what is going to save us, in my opinion. So
that's such good news, and it's wonderful to hear. So last question, because I've learned so much just hearing you talk about the methods you use and how you do help people and the information that is out there. So I'm going to put the links in the show notes. But why is it important for us to look at mind, body, and soul or spirit? Mind, body, soul. Not just the mind, not just your body, not just spirituality, because some people are so spiritual that they've lost their human elements. So why, you know, they're in the clouds. So why is it important for us to look at that holistic view, to have that holistic view?
Well, in my opinion, our primary responsibility is the use and care of our vehicles, so to speak, you know? I mean, our vital physical body, which, by the way, has to be understood as two sides of the same coin, right? Because we are alive. So we have a physical body, we have this energy body together. So, you know, we are responsible for the use and care of our physical vital body. We're responsible for the use and care of our emotional body and our mental body and our spiritual body. And that's our primary responsibility, is to care for ourselves on those multiple dimensions, on those multiple levels, because it is from that place that we can be of service in the world and, you know, fulfill our true calling, our purpose. Because even though, you know, some of us don't want to be here, and I just speak in, I'm not saying I don't want to be here, I just always speak in plural, because we're all connected, you know, we are all in this together. And, you know, some of us don't want to be here, even though we are here for a reason, you know, so it's better to not spend time trying to figure out or disconnect or whatever, but just, you know, fully inhabit your full, you know, potential, and discover why you're here, because I'm telling you, we all are here for a reason. It's not random. It's not random. It's not an accident. It is extremely purposeful. Our existence is extremely purposeful. And so if you can decode that information inside yourself and decipher what that is, and if you don't know it, just take a step. Just take a next step, and that will inform you. And then from that step, you will learn a little more. And then you just take another step. You don't have to be paralyzed until, okay, I don't know what my purpose is. I don't know. And then you do nothing. Just do something. Take a step. Look around. See what happens. Take another step. You'll get feedback, because the universe is very participatory and responsive to us. I'm sorry, I keep hitting my microphone. I hope that's not loud. Anyway, yeah, so that's my two cents on that.
That was very powerful, though, when you were saying we're here for a reason, you know, you're here for a reason. Very powerful energy when you were saying that.
Because it's the truth. We recognize the truth when we hear it. You know, we recognize it. And it is, it's the truth.
Well, I think we felt it when you said it. I certainly felt it. And I know that our viewers have felt it through the airwaves. So I think there will be people who needed to hear that. So I thank you for that. I know it's from the heart. And all of your work is from the heart. It's clear you're doing the work you're here to do. I mean, I don't think it could be any clearer. And some people,
I appreciate that.
Some people struggle and they'll get there. They'll find what they're meant to do. And you found what you were meant to do. So keep doing it. Oh, yes. And I just want to say, I don't know if you're still there, though. You were at a very prestigious resort, actually, for Four Seasons in different places.
It's true. Yes. I do work at the Four Seasons Resort on Maui in Wailea. And I'm also a master teacher at Four Seasons Costa Rica. So the Costa Rica assignment, shall we say, is in person. And, you know, it's I do kind of like a teacher in residence thing there. Whereas my work on Maui is more ongoing.
Yeah, that must be nice being in a resort. You see many different people and they're in a relaxed setting. So that,
yes.
Yeah, does it change?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things to it. One is, you know, they're in a relaxed setting, but it's also that they tend to be away, you know, far away. And so they feel safer, you know, to do things that they might not do in their, you know, in their surroundings at home. And I mean, also I can tell you, of course, a lot of people who stay at the Four Seasons, they tend to be affluent, you know, they tend to have a lot of money. And I mean, I can tell you that from my experience with that, money does not solve our problems. In case anybody was wondering, let me just tell you, does not.
Yeah, it helps in different ways, but certainly won't take away the issue. We still got to do the work.
It's true. There is no escape. No. There is no escaping it. You know, you have to do the work. We have to do the work. And, you know, the sooner you get going on it, the easier it is, of course. And yeah, it's, you know, what I've been pondering on most recently is this sad state of affairs that I think it's safe to say that for most of humanity, we still grow best through pain. And imagine what a world we could co-create if we changed that, if we were willing to make those types of fundamental shifts by choice on our own without having to have the spiritual 2x4. Maybe that's an Americanism, but a 2x4 is a really big board. And, you know, sometimes we need to get whacked with it before we actually wake up and do something. But imagine what a different world we could co-create if we were willing to make those significant shifts and grow by leaps and bounds simply by choice, by doing our own inner work, you know, without having the without being forced to.
Yeah. Our mission is to participate, I believe, in life, however that looks, whatever that is. And using your words, you're here for a reason. And maybe we've got to step up a bit more and, you know.
And be proactive. You know, don't wait for some kind of painful growth catalyst, you know, just to stay on top of your inner workings, of your inner process, you know, so that you can continue on your evolutionary path and, you know, speed it up of your own free will choice, of your own volition, speed it up on your own, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Deborah, I thank you so much. I mean, what a wealth of information you've shared today. And I know some people would not have heard of kinesiology, or even if they had, perhaps they didn't know a lot about it. So now we've got quite a good explanation from a practitioner, someone who uses it in their practice. So this has been so helpful. Thank you. I hope you come back at some point as well. It's been amazing. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful for me too. A blessing. Thank you.
And all the links will be in the show notes, especially to safetechhawaii.com as well. Although I like the way you say it.
Hawaii. Yes, that's how you pronounce it.
I love it.
In the Hawaiian language, it's pronounced Hawaii.
Hawaii. Oh, that's lovely.
Thanks so much for listening today. Make sure you subscribe and follow on all streaming platforms. Leave me a comment and also let me know if there's any particular topics you'd like me to discuss. See you next time.